Good morning. If you have a Bible, if you would please open to Acts chapter 28, Acts chapter 28. We're going to begin our lesson in this text in just a few moments. We appreciate your presence here today. A cold day outside, but it's beautiful to be able to be with one another, and we appreciate the interest that you have in spiritual matters that you show by coming to be here together with God's people. We appreciate, especially if you're visiting with us, we hope that if you have any questions, you'll feel free to ask any one of us, and we'll try to explain why it is that we do those things that we do. If we can be of any help to you, please don't hesitate to let us know. And we hope if you're in our area again, you'll come back and see us the next time that you're with us. In Acts chapter 28, I'd like for us to read beginning in verse 11, and we'll go down to verse 14 to introduce our lesson this morning. After 3 months, we sailed in an Alexandrian ship whose figurehead was the twin brothers, which had wintered at the island. And landing at Syracuse, we stayed 3 days. From there, we circled around and reached Rhegium. And after one day, the south wind blew, and the next day we came to Puteoli, where we found brethren and were invited to stay with them 7 days. And so we went toward Rome. This brief account here near the end of the book of Acts describes the Apostle Paul completing a journey to the ancient city of Rome, or at least coming very near to the completion of his journey. Rome was the seat of the Roman Empire that ruled the world of the ancient day, all of the Mediterranean area. There are a number of valuable lessons that we can learn about this event that allowed the Apostle Paul to journey to Rome that I'd like for us to think about for a few moments this morning as we consider together the Apostle Paul's journey to Rome. I'd like us to begin by recognizing the fact that this is something that Paul had actually desired to have happen. In other words, he had desired to go to Rome. We see this expressed if you'd look over in the book of Romans, in Romans chapter 15. There are some statements that he makes when he sends an epistle to the church in Rome that make it very clear that he desired to go to Rome and he desired to see the brethren who were there. If you'd read with me in Romans 15, beginning in verse 18, we'll go down to verse 25. The text says, "For I will not dare to speak of any of those things which Christ has not accomplished through me in word and deed to make the Gentiles obedient, in mighty signs and wonders by the power of the Spirit of God, so that from Jerusalem and round about to Illyricum I have fully preached the gospel of Christ. And so I have made it my aim to preach the gospel not where Christ was named, lest I should build on another man's foundation, but as it is written, to whom he was not announced, they shall see, and those who have not heard shall understand. For this reason, I also have been much hindered, notice, from coming to you. But now, no longer having a place in these parts, and having a great desire these many years to come to you, whenever I journey to Spain, I shall come to you, for I hope to see you on my journey, and to be helped on my way there by you, if first I may enjoy your company for a while." Now notice, "But now I am going to Jerusalem to minister to the saints." It is believed that Paul wrote these words in the book of Romans in about the year 57 A.D. And it is believed that he did so from the city of Corinth. And this is said because of a number of things that we see within this book. For example, in chapter 16, verse 1, he mentions a woman by the name of Phoebe, who was associated with the church in Cenchrea, which was a suburb of the city of Corinth. We say this as well because he claims in Romans 16, verse 23, to be the guest of a man by the name of Gaius. And we have another man by the name of Gaius that may in fact be the same individual that's mentioned in 1 Corinthians chapter 1 and verse 14, whom the Apostle Paul had converted. We say that he was probably in Corinth as well, because a greeting in chapter 16, verse 23 of the book of Romans is offered, a greeting to from Erastus. And we have in Corinth a man by the name of Erastus that is mentioned in 2 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 20. It is believed that Paul was planning to return to Jerusalem, as the text that we just read in verse 25 mentioned, with his gift for the saints there, which the churches had put together in order to help them in their need. And then it was his hope that he would go to Spain and to Rome and to a number of places as well. I want us to notice, though, if you turn back to Romans chapter 1 and verse 13, Romans chapter 1 and verse 13. The Apostle Paul at this stage had never been to the city of Rome. Rome, unlike so many of the cities in the Gentile world, was not one in which the church that was there was established by the Apostle Paul, because there was a church there that Paul addresses. And our conclusion generally is that those from the day of Pentecost that were converted may have returned back and been instrumental in establishing this church. But in chapter 1 and verse 13, you'll notice, "Now, I do not want you to be unaware, brethren, that I often planned to come to you, but was hindered until now, that I might have some fruit among you also, just as among the other Gentiles." So Paul had not been there. Paul had not been to Rome. But he has a desire to go to Rome. And I want us to think for a moment about why it was that the apostle desired to see Rome. You know, it might be that today we might have an interest to go and to see the city of Rome or to see Paris or something like that. What would be the reason that Paul would want to go? Did he want to go and to see the great monuments that were there? Already within Paul's day, there were wonderful things that he could have seen. Did he go to try to hope to meet some important people that somehow he might be able to establish some influence, even if that was his desire for the cause of Christ? Did he go to somehow gain some type of prestige? This is the capital of the ancient world. Was that why he wanted to go to Rome? I don't believe so. If you notice here in chapter 1 as well, if you go back up to verse 8 and then read down to verse 12, I think we see very well why it was that Paul wanted to go to Rome. He said, "First, I thank my God through Jesus Christ for you all, that your faith is spoken of throughout the whole world. For God is my witness, whom I serve with my spirit and the gospel of his Son, that without ceasing I make mention of you always in my prayers, making request, if by some means now at last I may find a way in the will of God to come to you." Now notice this. "For I long to see you, that I may impart to you some spiritual gift, so that you may be established. That is, that I may be encouraged together with you by the mutual faith both of you and me." His interest in going to Rome had nothing to do with these things about the city itself or the grandeur of it. Instead, he was interested in the spiritual well-being of those saints that were in Rome. However few, however many they were, he wanted, as he puts it there, to impart some spiritual gift to them that they may be established, verse 12, that they may be encouraged together in their mutual faith. Well, as we read in the text that we looked at the beginning, Paul makes it to Rome. But I want us to think for a few moments about the way that this happened. Because something happened in the midst of all this that changed his plans dramatically. Some things happened when the apostle went to Jerusalem. If you go over to the book of Acts, in Acts chapter 21, I want us to notice some things that we are told about the arrival of the apostle Paul in Jerusalem. Because while he did make it to Jerusalem, some things happened there that are going to dramatically change the plans that he had. In Acts chapter 21, notice with me beginning in verse 15, and we'll go down to verse 17. It says, "And after those days, we packed and went up to Jerusalem. Also, some of the disciples from Caesarea went with us and brought with them Mnason of Cyrus, an early disciple with whom we were to lodge. And when we had come to Jerusalem, the brethren received us gladly." So all is going well so far. He makes it to Jerusalem. But in chapter 21, skip down to verse 26, and I'd like for us to notice that some things happen as he goes into the temple that pose a bit of a problem or cause a bit of a problem. Notice beginning of verse 26. "Then Paul took the men, and the next day, having been purified with them, entered the temple to announce the expiration of the days of purification, at which time an offering should be made for each one of them. And when the 7 days were almost ended, the Jews from Asia, seeing him in the temple, stirred up the whole crowd and laid hands on him." Now, you might remember, if you are familiar with the book of Acts, that as he had been preaching and teaching in the area of what we would refer to as Asia Minor, not Asia as in China or India, but Asia Minor in the area of modern day Turkey,
that there have been many Jews that once they learned what Paul was teaching, actually began to oppose him and in some instances would go following him from city to city. Here, some of them had actually gone all the way back to Jerusalem and began to stir up the people against him. Verse 28, crying out, "Men of Israel, help! This is the man who teaches all men everywhere against the people, the law, and this place. And furthermore, he has brought Greeks into the temple and has defiled this holy place. For they had previously seen Trophimus, the Ephesian, with him in the city, whom they supposed that Paul had brought into the temple. And all the city was disturbed, and the people ran together, seized Paul, and dragged him out of the temple, and immediately the doors were shut. Now, as they were seeking to kill him, news came to the commander of the garrison that all Jerusalem was in an uproar." Now, we've got a bit of a problem. His plan to come to Jerusalem and then to go to Rome all of a sudden faces a little bit of a difficulty here, because these Jews that have followed him from Asia have stirred up the people against him. Now, you would think that this would be solved easily enough, because the fact was that he had not brought a Gentile into the temple. Paul, in his respect for the ordinance of God and his respect for what the way in which the Jews still worshipped, had not done that. You would think that it would have been easy enough for this problem to be resolved. What we find is that Paul speaks to the crowd about Jesus and about his conversion. And I'd like us to notice some things about the outcome. If you'd look over in chapter 22... read with me verses 22 through 24. It says, "And they listened to him until this word, and then they raised their voices and said, 'Away with such a fellow from the earth, for he is not fit to live.'" Now, the word that he had just mentioned, if you look back a little bit before this, was the fact that the gospel was to go to the Gentile world. We've already seen that they were very upset at the very possibility that a Gentile might come into the temple. Here, suggesting that the gospel of God would go as well to the Gentile world, inflamed them. Notice verse 23. "Then as they cried out and tore off their clothes and threw dust into the air, the commander ordered him to be brought into the barracks and said that he should be examined under scourging so that he might know why they shouted so against him." Now, there's a little bit of a problem with this that this commander doesn't recognize. And that is the fact that you don't treat a Roman citizen that way. You see, it was highly possible for Romans to treat those that were a part of the provinces in this way, and they could basically treat them how they chose to. But Paul was unique in the fact that he had been born in the city of Tarsus, which was recognized as a Roman city. And as a result, one who was born in the city of Tarsus was a Roman citizen and subject to the protections of being a Roman citizen. They don't, in fact, beat him because of this, but they do call him before the Jewish council. And if you'd skip over in chapter 23, we see that Paul is given the opportunity to speak before the council. But I want you to notice just a couple of things, verses 10 and 11. "And when they arose, a great dissension, the commander, fearing lest Paul might be pulled to pieces by them, commanded the soldiers to go down and to take him by force from among them and to bring him into the barracks." Now, if you read a few verses before this, you'll see that as Paul speaks before the council, he plays upon the fact that that council was made up of those that were both Pharisees and Sadducees. He plays upon the fact that some of them believed in the resurrection and some of them did not. And he confesses his faith that there will be a resurrection of the dead and that they will be, as in verse 6, judged. Now, I want you to notice a few things about this. In the course of this, as we see this trouble that's developed, as he planned to go to Jerusalem and then on his way to Rome, here he's been arrested. Here he has been seized and he's been, in many cases, his life's been in peril. And had it not been for this Gentile commander, his life probably would have been lost. In the course of this, the Lord reveals something to the Apostle Paul. The Lord reveals to him that he will in fact get his wish. In fact, he will go to the city of Rome. What will it be that he'll be able to accomplish there? Will he be able to have a private audience with Caesar? Will he speak as a great guest of honor before the Roman Senate? Would the Jews who were in Rome accept the gospel and want to know more about what it was that he was teaching? Well, how does it work out? Well, if you look over in Acts chapter 23 and verse 12, we learn that in the course of this instance, there's a plot that arises, a plot to kill the Apostle Paul. In verse 12, we learn that there were 40 Jews that vowed that they would kill Paul. Fortunately, news of this makes it to the Apostle Paul through one of his relatives. And he is taken to Caesarea by 200 soldiers, Acts chapter 24 tells us. There, he is brought before the governor Felix, who hears him. But he's not released, because Felix is not a man of courage, not a man of character. Instead, he holds him for 2 years. Now, all of a sudden, Paul's plan to go to Rome, his plan to encourage the brethren, has been dramatically changed. 2 years is not a short period of time. 2 years is not a short period of time to be bound and restricted and held and not allowed to do those things that were noble efforts that he wanted to accomplish. But all of a sudden, because of this turn of events, he's held for 2 years. Now we learn as we progress in the book of Acts in chapter 25 that a new governor, a man by the name of Festus, comes on scene. The Jews renew their complaints and they want Paul brought to Jerusalem, hoping that they can ambush him along the way. Turn over to Acts chapter 25 and look with me at verses 7 through 12. Acts chapter 25, verses 7 through 12. It says, When he had come, the Jews who had come down from Jerusalem stood about and laid many serious complaints against Paul, which they could not prove. While he answered for himself, neither against the law of the Jews, nor against the temple, nor against Caesar, have I offended in anything at all. But Festus, wanting to do the Jews a favor, answered Paul and said, are you willing to go up to Jerusalem and there be judged before me concerning these things? Then Paul said, I stand at Caesar's judgment seat, where I ought to be judged. To the Jews I have done no wrong, as you very well know. For if I am an offender or have committed anything worthy of death, I do not object to dying. But if there is nothing in these things of which these men accuse me, no one can deliver me to them. I appeal to Caesar. And Festus, when he had conferred with the council, had answered, you have appealed to Caesar. To Caesar you shall go. And notice, in this situation where this plot is in the works to kill him, rather than going back to Jerusalem, he appeals to Caesar. And so he's going to Rome. Now, we may think to ourselves, well, all right, he's finally accomplishing his desire. He's finally able to make it to Rome so that he can carry out this good work that he had in mind to do, to encourage the brethren, to edify them, to impart to them a spiritual gift. Well, let's look at how this plays out. Look over in chapter 27. You know, we've all probably had trips that we've taken that didn't quite turn out the way that we wanted. You know, that when we took Tori to school, we had no wish or desire that we'd have an accident and we'd have that kind of turmoil. I'm sure many of you have had instances where things just don't work out quite the way that you plan. Well, I'm sure the Apostle Paul, even at this stage, as he's been bound and held for years now, perhaps at least he thinks within himself, all right, well, at least I'm headed in the right direction. Everything will be smooth sailing from here on out, right? Well, let's look in Acts chapter 27 and read the first 8 verses. And when it was decided that we should sail to Italy, they delivered Paul and some other prisoners to one named Julius, a centurion of the Augustan regiment. So entering a ship of Adramyttium, we put to sea, and meaning to sail along the coasts of Asia, Aristarchus, a Macedonian of Thessalonica, was with us. And the next day we landed at Sidon, and Julius treated Paul kindly and gave him liberty to go to his friends and receive care. When we had put to sea from there, we sailed under the shelter of Cyprus, because the winds were contrary. And when we had sailed over the sea, which is off Cilicia and Palmyra, We came to Myra, a city of Lycia. There, the centurion found an Alexandrian ship sailing to Italy, and he put us on board. And when we had sailed slowly many days and arrived with difficulty off Sidonis, the wind not permitting us to proceed, we sailed under the shelter of Crete off Salmone. Passing it with difficulty, we came to a place called Fair Havens near the city of Lycia. Now, so far, everything seems to be what you might expect on a difficult journey like this. You know, we're not talking about catching a flight. We're not talking about something where you can do it with great ease. But things begin to change when they leave Crete. I want us to notice in Acts chapter 27, first of all, verses 10 and 11. It says, saying, "Men, I perceive that this voyage will end with disaster and much loss, not only of the cargo and ship, but also our lives. Nevertheless, the centurion was more persuaded by the helmsman and the owner of the ship than by the things spoken by Paul." Let's get down, if you would, to verses 18 through 26. "And because we were exceedingly tempest-tossed, the next day they lightened the ship. On the third day, we threw the ship's tackle overboard with our own hands. Now, when neither sun nor stars appeared for many days and no small tempest beat on us, all hope that we would be saved was finally given up." Continue reading. "But after long abstinence from food, Paul stood in the midst of them and said, 'Men, you should have listened to me and not have sailed from Crete and incurred this disaster and loss. And now I urge you to take heart, for there will be no loss of life among you, but only of the ship. For there stood by me this night an angel of God, to whom I belong and whom I serve, saying, 'Do not be afraid, Paul. You must be brought before Caesar, and indeed God has granted you all those who sail with you. Therefore take heart, men, for I believe God that it will be just as he told me. However, we must run aground on a certain island.'" Now, I want you to think about this. And I want you to think about it from the standpoint of a real man that's experiencing these things in his efforts to serve the Lord. Here, his desire had been simply to go to Rome and to be able to encourage the brethren there. His effort had been that he would go to Jerusalem and bring this gift to the saints there. But in the course of that, he's arrested, he's bound, he's falsely accused. He nearly loses his life. Well, he finally progresses on his way. But even that doesn't go smoothly, because what we see is that as he is journeying, even that can't be something that just happens in an easy manner. The ship, in fact, is lost. And that brings us to the last part of chapter 27, leading up to where we read at the beginning of our lesson. Notice chapter 27, verse 41, and we'll go down into the first verse of the next chapter. It says, "But striking a place where two seas met, they ran the ship aground, and the prow stuck fast and remained immovable. But the stern was being broken up by the violence of the waves. Now the soldiers' plan was to kill the prisoners, lest any of them should swim away and escape. But the centurion, wanting to save Paul, kept them from their purpose and commanded that those who could swim should jump overboard first and get to land. And the rest, some on boards and some on broken pieces of the ship. And so it was that they all escaped safely to land. Now, when they had escaped, they found out that the island was called Malta." This is not going well. This is not how I am certain Paul might have imagined that this journey to Rome would come about. In fact, while he's there, the first 10 verses of Acts chapter 28 indicate to us that even at this point, the man is snake bitten as they are gathering wood and a snake latches onto his hand. Now, thanks be to God, he didn't die from that, as Jesus had promised in Mark chapter 16. There'd be those that would take up serpents and would not die because the Lord was with them. But still, imagine all that this man is going through. And yet finally, as we read at the beginning of our lesson, verses 11 through 14, he makes it to Rome. Now I want you to think about this again from a very personal standpoint. Imagine how easy it would have been for Paul to feel in the process of all this, when he's just wanting to do the Lord's work, he's just wanting to do what's right. Imagine how easy it would have been for him to feel like things were just not going as they should. This is not what he had in mind. This is not certainly what he must have bargained for when he was obedient to the gospel. His goal is to go to Rome, but in the course of this, he faces prison. He faces shipwreck. He faces being snake bitten. He faces hardship upon hardship. Wouldn't it have been easy for Paul to simply say, well, obviously this isn't what I thought it was? Wouldn't it have been easy for Paul to simply give up? What would you have done? What would I have done if I was in that kind of circumstance and faced all of these things? Sometimes it's very difficult when we commit ourselves to obedience to the Lord and then are forced to recognize that God's way to give us perhaps what we desire or what's best for us may not be what we anticipated or may not be what we thought it would be. We sometimes face the same kind of challenges. I'd like us to think for just a few moments about our own lives because, you know, we face goals as well. Perhaps not the same type of goal that Paul had of going to Rome to try to encourage the brethren, but we face, for example, a goal of heaven. We set before us this goal that we want eternal life, that we want to live with God eternally, that we want at the end of this age to be with Him and not to be separated from Him. But the way that we get to that goal involves giving up things that we might choose to engage in, giving up things that we might even enjoy. It involves perhaps choosing not to spend time with people of the world, but instead we must spend time with God's people in an effort to encourage them. It involves, in some cases, looking at ourselves and looking at our character and recognizing when we see that there are those things that should not be what we find within our heart and within our lives, we've got to change those things. And it may be that that's really not what we expected. It may be that we are tempted to say, well, this isn't the way to the goal. I'll try something else. Look with me over in Matthew chapter 16 for a moment. In Matthew chapter 16. And I'd like us to just think about this and see the example of the Apostle Paul here that however it was that this man was able to face all of these things and yet still see it as just right in line with what God wanted to accomplish in his life, that everything was going as it should, that there was no reason to despair. Notice in Matthew chapter 16, read with me beginning in verse 24, and perhaps it will help us to recognize that part of what we are doing when we are obedient to the gospel is we are being called upon to expect the unexpected. We are being called upon to accept what we might not choose. Notice in Matthew chapter 16, verse 24, then Jesus said to his disciples, if anyone desires to come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever desires to save his life will lose it, and whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. For what is a man profited if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul? Or what will a man give in exchange for his soul? Jesus here, as he talks about what it means to be a disciple, teaches us that it's going to involve denial of self. It's going to involve those things that we might not have chosen, we might not have wanted for our life to be. And yet that's just the course. That's just the way of following him. Notice these dramatic words in 25, that whoever desires to save his life will lose it. You ever thought about that? That when you're obedient to the gospel, you are in essence saying, I give my life up. Those wishes, those desires, that picture in our mind of what our life's going to be, we've got to recognize is going to be different. Just like Paul had to recognize, you know what, I thought I was going to go to Rome, nice and pleasant trip, and yet it involved prison, it involved hardship, it involved all of these things. Turn over, if you would, to Matthew chapter 7. Matthew chapter 7. In the Sermon on the Mount, I think Jesus points out as well to us that this very course of choosing life, this very course of choosing obedience as a disciple of Jesus Christ is not going to be a path that's easy. Now, that's not good marketing if you want to think of it in terms of trying to get everybody in the world to follow and to become a Christian and to become a disciple of Jesus Christ. But you know, Jesus is not about good marketing. Jesus is not about just trying to get anyone with any disposition of heart, anyone with any hardened, rebellious determination to do their own will. Jesus is about asking men, commanding men to conform their lives to His way. And so He tells us in Matthew chapter 7, verse 13, "Enter by the narrow gate, for wide is the gate and broad is the way that leads to destruction, and there are many who go in by it, because narrow is the gate and difficult is the way which leads to life, and there are few who find it." Now you may say to yourself, well, why in the world would anybody want to choose that? I'll tell you why you'd want to choose that, because of what lays at the end, life. You know, you look at your own situation. You look at your own life, and you know, we live in a country in which we're very blessed, in which things, you know, even on our worst day in the world, we've got it so much better than scores of people, not only in the world today, but throughout human history have had it. We don't realize that. It's easy for us sometimes to feel sorry for ourselves, but it's the truth, and we've got to recognize it. But I'll tell you, there's a real danger sometimes, I think, for we as Christians, when we live in a comfortable world, when we live in a culture in which we have freedom to worship, when we live around those that tolerate a desire to try to do what God wants in their life, it may be that sometimes when we have such ease that it's very easy for us to not have the attitude that being a Christian means the way is difficult. It may be very easy for us sometimes to too easily conform ourselves to the things of this world and to enjoy the things of this life. Now, I'm not saying that as a Christian we can never enjoy anything. I'm not saying that as a Christian we should never have a smile upon our face and we should be miserable at all times. But we must recognize, like Paul had to recognize, that sometimes the way to our goal is going to be different than what we expected. And we shouldn't be discouraged by that. Notice another example of this. And that is what we could call the goal of honest living. You know, as a Christian, we make it our goal to live in an honorable way, to work not as criminals, not thwarting the laws, and not trying to just gain those things that we need for life through any means. And yet, as we look at the world around us, we say may see many, even that we work with, or that our neighbors, or that are our friends, that profit by dishonesty. We may see those who who engage in those things that are questionable. And we can look at that and we can recognize, you know what? If I did that, I could have what they have. If I was just not quite as honest, or if I just bent the truth a little bit, if I just didn't declare everything, if I just didn't tell the whole truth. And we may sometimes, as we face that realization, that here's what the world does, and yet we're trying to be honest and upright, we may sometimes feel like we're banging our head against the wall, just trying to make ends meet, and never can. And again, the temptation, I think, is to say, well, I'm just going to quit trying to be honest. I'm going to quit trying to be so upright. Look over in Matthew chapter 6 with me for a moment. One thing we've got to recognize, you know, aside from the fact that these things are all temporary, aside from the fact that one day all this is going to be burned up, we have to recognize that what really matters in the long run is not what we can see with our eyes, not what man sees, but what God sees. Because we have to recognize that when we strive to live a life that is honest and honorable, whether anybody else in the world ever acknowledges that and recognizes that, whether anybody ever pats you on the back and says, you're doing a good job, you're doing what's right. I know it's hard for you. I know that it'd be easier if you pursued this other route that's ungodly and unlawful. Even if nobody ever acknowledges that, God sees that. Notice here in Matthew chapter 6, beginning verse 1, it says, "Take heed that you do not do your charitable deeds before men to be seen by them. Otherwise, you have no reward from your Father in heaven." Now, notice the context here is talking about charitable deeds or alms. But I want you to notice something that's said in the course of this. We're not really talking about alms or charitable deeds right now. But look at what it says. Therefore, when you do a charitable deed, do not sound a trumpet before you as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets, that they may have glory from men. Assuredly, I say to you, they have their reward. But when you do a charitable deed, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, that your charitable deed may be in secret. Notice, and your Father who sees in secret will himself reward you openly. We have to cling to that hope. We have to cling to that hope that if we live in a corrupt world in which everybody around us is doing what's wrong, and we're laughed at, we're scorned, we're treated as if we're fools, God sees. And one day, God will acknowledge that openly. And then who will be the fool? Then who will it be that is scorned? Not by man, but by God. Look over, if you would, in Ephesians chapter 6. In Ephesians chapter 6, read with me verses 5 through 8. There's a principle that's laid down when it comes to the way that we live our lives. Why is it that we are good employees? Why is it that we are honorable employers? Why is it that we are good students? Why is it that we are good teachers? Why is it that in any course of life that we may be in, if you're on a team, you are a good player. If you are in some effort, you're doing your best. Why is that? Is it for personal glory? No. I want you to notice something that the apostle says in Ephesians chapter 6, beginning in verse 5, as he talks to servants. Now recognize that, as we mentioned at the beginning of our lesson, in this world in which Rome dominated so much, you have a population throughout the Roman Empire that's largely made up of forced labor, slaves, servants. Those who either had been sold into servitude, those who had become slaves through conquest, that had no free will, that had no choice over those things that they wanted within their life. And yet I want you to notice what the apostle says to these servants who are Christians. He says, "Servants, be obedient to those who are your masters according to the flesh, with fear and trembling and sincerity of heart," notice, "as to Christ. Not with eye service as men pleasers, but as servants of Christ doing the will of God from the heart. With goodwill doing service," notice again, "as to the Lord, not to men, knowing that whatever good anyone does, he will receive the same from the Lord, whether he is a slave or free." You know, I know that there are those who face circumstances where you've got bosses, you've got teachers, you've got coaches, whatever it may be, that are just unfair, that are just not right, that don't honor you, that don't treat you with an ounce of respect. And it may be very easy for you sometimes to think, well, I'm just not going to do what I should when they're not looking, or I'm not going to give them the reverence or the respect that they are due. But recognize that whether they deserve it or not, you as a Christian are given an opportunity to live the way that you ought to allow Christ to shine through your life. And you don't do it because they're such a good person. You do it because the Lord's such a good person. You do it as serving the Lord. Two final things, and we'll bring our lesson to a close. Notice as well a goal that we have that we might speak of as the goal of purity. As Christians, we're called upon to control ourselves. We're to control our temper. We're to control our actions. That's why we don't engage in drugs and drink, which would compromise our sobriety. That's why we don't give ourselves to fornication and immorality, which would compromise the temple of the Holy Spirit, as we talked about in our class this morning. Yet in the course of doing this, the way that we must attain this goal is to be in a world in which we face those all around us who throw their immorality in our face, who treat us as if we are foolish if we try to control ourselves, that it's impossible to control yourself. We face disappointments that sometimes make us very tempted to, through a lack of self-control, escape from the hardships of reality. We face a circumstance in which self-control is not an easy thing. It is a difficult, painful kind of situation. And of course, the temptation is to say, well, no one is self-controlled anymore. Why should I be? Or perhaps we may even say, well, I can't resist temptation. Look over in 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 13. It is a great comfort to us. We talked in our class this morning about the assurance that we can have that God's expectations don't change. Another assurance that we can have is the fact that there is nothing that God asks of us that we cannot accomplish. In 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 13, notice, no temptation has overtaken you except such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you were able, but with the temptation will also make the way of escape that you may be able to bear it. The world may say, you can't do that. The Lord says, you can. You can. There is nothing, there is no temptation that will be set before you that you cannot bear. The challenge is to do so. The challenge is to endure. We read the text in our adult class this morning, in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verses 19 and 20, which point out that we've got to recognize that there's something honorable about this position that we're put in. As Christians, this body that we are given, though it's a body of dust, becomes the temple of the Holy Spirit. When we allow the revelation of God to dwell within us, something honorable and noble and greater than all the filth of this world is within us. And we cannot allow ourselves to just go the way of the world because we have the Spirit of God within us. The last goal that I'd like for us to think about as we think about this is what we could call the goal of family fidelity. I don't know the best way to put this, but what I mean is that we want to be good husbands. We want to be good wives. We want to be good parents. We want to be good children. And we set that as a goal before us. But we recognize that that as well sometimes involves things that we might not expect. You know, we've got brothers and sisters and parents and husbands and wives that may have those kinds of habits that just annoy us, or may have those kinds of things that are difficult to bear with. There may be times that we feel unappreciated. There may be times that we feel like so-and-so takes advantage of us. Or we may feel that we're misunderstood. And the temptation is to say, well, I'm just going to give up. What good is it trying to be a good husband or a good wife or a good father or a good mother or a good child? I'll just do what I want to do. It may be very easy for us to think, well, God doesn't know what I have to go through. We acknowledged in our class this morning, God knows all things. He knows our thoughts. He knows our heart. It may be tempting for us to say, well, my parents don't know what they're talking about. Or it may be easy for us to say as parents, well, I don't know how in the world to raise children anyway. And it's easy for us, because that course is not what we expected, to say to ourselves, well, this just wasn't what I bargained for. Look over in Colossians chapter 3. Colossians chapter 3. We have to recognize that we have an honorable task when we have that relationship of family, that we must bear up to the responsibilities that we have within that family. Because one of the reasons, if nothing else, is because we have a bearing upon the salvation of those within our family. In addition to that, the way that we bear up to that will have a bearing upon our own salvation. And in many cases, a bearing upon the salvation of those around us. Notice Colossians chapter 3, beginning of verse 18, these simple instructions. Wives, submit to your own husbands as is fitting to the Lord. Husbands, love your wives and do not be bitter toward them. Children, obey your parents in all things, for this is well-pleasing to the Lord. Fathers, do not provoke your children, lest they become discouraged. Well, Paul made it to his goal of Rome, but it was much different than he might have ever imagined. But the wonderful lesson of Paul is that he didn't give up. He didn't say God had abandoned him. He didn't say this wasn't what he bargained for. He just accepted what God laid before him. And if we are to deny ourselves, if we are to take up our cross and follow after him, we must recognize as we face that narrow but difficult way that there'll be those things in our lives that may not have been what we expected, may not have been the way we thought it would play out. But if we have the commitment to remain faithful to the Lord, as Paul did, we can recognize that just as in the case of Paul, look at what happened with him. Though it was different than what he planned, his life and those things that played out served to bless scores of other people, not only in his day and age, but it continues to bless us today. If we can recognize that same thing, how can our lives serve to bless other people if we will but persevere as we strive towards those goals that we set before us? It may be that there's some here this morning that have never yet set before your heart and your soul the goal of eternal life. I would urge you this morning to recognize that as enduring as these things seem to be, one day all of this that we cling to is going to be gone. But what will matter are the spiritual things. What will matter is if we put our faith in Jesus as the Son of God. If we confess that faith before men, if we've repented and turned away from sin, and we've denied ourselves, and we've died in the waters of baptism for the remission of our sins. If you've never done that, all things are prepared and ready this morning. We could baptize you into Christ. If as a child of God, you recognize that you may be of that sort that we were talking about, that you, whether you've said it to another soul or not, you've been thinking, this isn't what I bargained for. This isn't the way I thought it would be. And I just don't know if I can keep going. Well, I hope we've seen from the lesson this morning, there may be things that are different than you expected. But it doesn't mean that those goals that you set before you are not still as true and sure if we'll just persevere. If we can encourage